Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 195, recorded for January 11th, 2023. The Cloud Pod can't wait for Azure Ultra Fungible Storage Premium. Good evening, Jonathan and Ryan. How's it going?
Great. Thanks, Justin. How are you?
Yeah, you know, another week. It's been a busy one for me personally and for some of you as well. But, you know, it's been kickoff season, you know, SKO, PKOs, all kinds of things for companies kicking off their new year in 2023 and all of them going like, oh, man, the future looks not great with recessionary headwinds in the future and everyone being a little bit cautious. So it's a little bit interesting. There's like excitement because it's a new year and tepid reaction to that because maybe it's not going to be great. Yeah. So sort of the energy that I'm feeling in the world these days.
What I want to build is fantastic. Getting the money to build it, not looking great.
Not looking so great. And then, you know, then you have your government, you know, you're not being able to figure out its stuff for, you know, 15 votes and, you know, all kinds of fun things. So it's just a crapshoot all over the place. Mm. Yeah,
it's the time of year when we start telling the teams, you know, it's going to be tough for the first quarter of the year. But if we get through this first quarter, I can't make any promises. But it might just get better after that.
Or it might just get worse. All right. Well, let's get into some news once again. Amazon is laying off 18,000 corporate and tech workers, apparently, per Andy Jassy blog post that he wrote. Previously, it had been rumored to only be about 10,000 employees and very heavily focused at Alexa. But the blog post clarifies that it is impacting all of Amazon's business units, including AWS, which impacts us here at the cloud. And there is a quote here from Andy Jassy himself. These changes will help us pursue our long-term opportunities with a stronger cost structure. However, I'm also optimistic that we'll be inventive, resourceful, and scrappy in this time when we're not hiring expansively and limiting some roles. Which then, of course, spurred, we should bring Bezos back. The Wall Street people, they did it at Disney. Why can't they do it at Amazon? But I have more confidence in Andy Jassy than I did in Disney's former CEO. So I think... I think it's going to be Andy Jassy for the foreseeable future, unless things go really, really badly there. But, you know, I think this is, again, people are taking haircuts, they're right-sizing some of their cost structures, trying to get things on the right track. And I don't think it'll be a huge impact. It's probably just low performers being knocked out.
I mean, 18,000, even at the scale of Amazon and their 1.6 million employees is, I mean, it sounds like a lot. It is a lot in absolute numbers of people.
But it's 5% is what the article said. So, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, to think of that being 5%, but that's, you know, it is still significant numbers, but yeah, it's not like they're cutting off an arm.
Agreed. So hopefully we're almost through layoffs. Cause it's kind of depressing, but you know, maybe things will get better and you know, economy recover and we'll take over the world. It'll be fine. Other AWS news, Amazon S3 encrypts new objects by default, which is sort of funny because the article starts out with this comment that AWS is the top priority, security is the top priority at AWS, which is funny because, you know, Werner Vogels wore a t-shirt, I think 3 years ago now, where it said encrypt everything. And we always sort of joke that, well, it's kind of silly because none of their stuff encrypts by default. But now it does. So S3 will automatically apply SSE-S3 encryption for each new object unless you specify a different encryption type. This puts another security best practice into effect automatically with no impact on performance and no action required by the end user. Existing buckets that use S3 default encryption will not be changed. And if you're using server-side encryption beyond SSE-S3, like the SSE-C for customer managed keys or SSE.KMS, as well as a host of client-side encryption options leveraging the Amazon encryption client, they will all not be impacted by this change. However, if you weren't using anything, they just turned on encryption for you and didn't give you any warning or tell you anything about it until this article went out. And I've yet to get an announcement on my Amazon account that this was done. So if all of a sudden, you know, you were already encrypting with like a third-party service that didn't talk Amazon, like, you know, for metric, now you're double encrypted. So, hey, you're doubly secure. So congratulations.
I mean, it's, you know, I think we just misunderstood the tone of Werner's t-shirt, you know, dance like no one's watching, encrypt like everyone is. It was more of an imploring request for us to do it. And then when we didn't 3 years later, they're just stomping all over it, right? That's encrypt by default. My theory.
It's funny that it's their oldest service. And, you know, as of the announcement, the last one to get encryption by default. And I'll be honest, and I'll tell you, I, I actually thought that it was encrypted on disk, but just not with keys, not with any kind of customer accessible keys.
I mean, it might have been, but why would you even announce this then? Or why would you make a change? But
the server-side encryption option, you don't get access to the keys, right? Or did I misunderstand?
No, that? The SSE-S3, you do not get access to the keys. It's just managed for you. But it's not on by default. Well, it is now.
Yeah.
But it was not owned by default before.
Right. I knew that. But yeah, and I sort of felt like that might have been a little bit of a checkbox. And there's other areas that get sort of strange with encryption and storage, right? You want the ability at the infrastructure level to dedupe at the block level and that. And I imagine that enabling that, you know, prevents some of that, but maybe not. Maybe they're addressing it now too. So
yeah. I mean, like, server-side encryption is sort of a weird thing, right? Because the reality is that the way that the data is going to get exposed is through an Amazon S3, you know, Amazon keys or an Amazon API that's already decrypting the data as it sends it to you. And so really you're protecting yourselves from, like, hey, the hardware got accessed or they threw away my drive that had my encrypted data on it. That's really what you're protecting with server-side encryption. The whole idea of server-side encryption always sort of felt like a checkbox for compliance anyways. And really, if you want a true encryption that Amazon couldn't touch or do anything with, you got client-side encryption, and then the data was always encrypted until you had it downloaded and went through the process. So it's always sort of been like this kind of like, yeah, it's encryption and we checked the box, but, like, you know, your data is still going to get exposed because it's going to get exposed through either a public endpoint that decrypting this automatically or through an exploit of Amazon keys or some other API access problem. So that's my hot take on server-side encryption for you.
I used to like to envision, like, a cat burglar breaking into an Amazon data center and stealing, like, a single drive out of a giant storage device and then, like, running off with it and, like, aha, but it's encrypted, we're fine. But the reality is probably more closer to what you said, which is, like, no, they just old hardware putting out to be recycled has data on.
Yeah, but you can't tell me that Amazon doesn't have a secure destruction policy and that they don't just shred all of that data. You know, anything coming out of the data center just probably gets thrown to a big, massive shredder up front. So I don't know.
I mean, there's always opportunities for, you know, hardware to fall off a truck or, you know.
Sure, sure.
So I'd be more worried about that. I'm sure they do have a secure, you know, policy. But I also know that, you know, it's a bunch of things that moving parts and could be easy to get something lost, and that would suck, right? Like, that'd be a terrible way to get your data, sensitive data, exposed on the internet, right?
Mm-hmm. Hey, how did this get out to the world? Well, it was on a drive that was at Amazon that got lost in a truck, fell off the back of it. Some guy picked it up off the street. Like, I mean, yeah, it's a bare minimum. It's the reason why it's a checkbox, but it's a stupid checkbox. Like, if you're really serious about encryption, you got to get client side.
Yeah.
And if you're an app, you gotta get app security, you know, into the app side as well. So, but
anyway. I am glad this is on by default.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to it. I just want to acknowledge that the elephant in the room says this is kind of just security through obscurity, but it's fine. Yeah. All right. Well, AWS App Runner now makes it easy to run web apps and APIs at production scale, and you can now build, deploy, run, and observe web applications without the burden associated with infra management. Many such applications leverage the external storage of URLs, API keys, usernames, database secrets, and configuration parameters. And apparently, until today, you could not store those in Secrets Manager or SSM parameters natively. I'm sure you could through an API or SDK that you had to deploy in your App Runner, but now it's natively integrated. So you can use the terrible AWS SSM parameter store at a fraction of the price, or the AWS Secrets Manager to now store all those secrets around URLs, API keys, etc. for your App Runner systems. So one of those checkboxes, like, I thought that was already there, but wasn't.
I mean, if you ignore the terrible name of Parameter Store and you never have to go to the console because you use the API, it's actually a pretty decent service.
Yeah, just don't ever look it up in the console.
In the console, it's like nine layers under Service Manager? Systems Manager.
I kind of wonder if it's like, you know, App Runner is a great intro to running apps, but maybe it's not what you want in production or not at scale. And by standardizing the way that secrets are delivered to the running container in the same way as they are in ECS or EKS or anything else, then it'd be easier to write your app and then move it elsewhere in the future, move it to a different container platform.
I mean, I imagine that the underneath of running an application, whether if you're deploying it on ECS and managing it yourself versus putting it in AppRunner, I imagine that hosting is exactly the same. I feel like this is just sort of Amazon doing exactly what we asked, which is like stringing all these technologies together, probably using CloudFormation and just sort of doing the part for us. And so like those are the weird edge cases that you know, used to be Beanstalk, right? You'd hit that and you'd be like, ah, it doesn't do that thing. Now I got to go build out a whole thing. You know, like I feel like this is just one of those and they slowly resolve those over time. Makes it easy.
Yeah. I mean, I guess AppRunner really is just Beanstalk for containers.
It really is. Yep. And it's one of like six services that's Beanstalk for containers that they have now. So it's even more confusing.
Yeah. I mean, there's many ways to run your container on AWS. I think there's 12, in fact. So yeah. This one, if you don't like this one, there's another one that you could try.
Yeah.
Just, you know,
well, it's great because I think it's just repackaging the same technology, right? It's just a new shiny outside candy coating.
Yeah. Like, which API do you like better?
Yeah.
Like this one or that one? Oh, you like JSON? Oh, I got one over here for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a, you know, choose your own language that makes you happy. So which one brings you joy, as maybe Quanta would say? Which one brings you joy?
Would be a fun flow chart to build, right? Like,
yeah.
I want to run a container on AWS and go through the decision tree. It'd just be circles.
Man, that would be a lot of options. But yeah, it'd be fun to pick.
It's a fairly new service, past couple of years, AppRunner, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think it just speaks to the increased focus on developer productivity and developer happiness, which Google succeeded in for years and only seems to be a recent concern for AWS.
Did Google succeed at it?
They said they did.
They claim it, like, and the big data people say it, but
that's a lot of the story behind Kubernetes in general, right? Is that story. So I think that the success of Kubernetes is largely
that's true. I mean,
that play.
And again, my use case that I'm currently using GC4 is not using Kubernetes. So maybe that's my problem. Maybe I just need more Kubernetes in my life and I'd be happier.
That seems to be the prevailing theory in all things computers. Just add Kubernetes.
Yeah, you know how you fix complexity and problems? You add more complexity and problems. It's brilliant.
Those problems seem far smaller once you've added Kubernetes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That problem's minor compared to this orchestration problem and service mesh issue I had to figure out. Yeah. Man, yeah. Who cares about that? You know, we're losing data over there, but I got to figure out how to make service mesh work. Like, yeah. Screw that. Speaking of GCP, let's move on to them. Today's modern analytics first and data-driven era, the need for reliable processing of complex transactions extends beyond just the traditional OLTP database. And today, businesses also have to trust their analytics environments are processing transactional data in an atomic, consistent, isolated, and durable ACID-compliant manner. To address this, BigQuery set out to support DML statements spanning large numbers of tables in a single transaction and commit the associated changes atomically, which means all at once for those who have not been in the lingo, is successfully or rollback atomically on failure. Previously launched in preview, it's now time for general availability of multi-statement transactions with BigQuery. While in preview, it was found to be highly effective for customer use cases, including keeping BigQuery synced with data stored in OLTP databases, the complex post-processing events pre-ingested into BigQuery, complying with GDPR's right to be forgotten, and many other use cases. And in fact, they have a quote here from Tokuya Ogawa, lead product engineer. We see multi-statement transactions as a valuable feature for achieving expressive and fast analytics capabilities for developers. It keeps queries simple and less hassle and error handling. And for users, it always gives reliable results. The multi-statement transactions are also fully compatible with BigQuery sessions and procedural language scripting. And for those of you who are not familiar with sessions, they are useful because they store state and enable use of temporary tables and variables. A procedural language allows you to use if, then, and while loops in your query, which can never go wrong in a SQL query, for sure. I didn't forget to mention that Takuya Ogawa is from Plaid. So he is definitely doing a lot of connections between multiple database systems and needs to query data for Plaid to interconnect with all those banks.
I'm just super excited because for the first time in one of these BigQuery or basically database sort of announcements, I actually know what all these things mean now, which is great. You know, like my more recent explorations into relational databases and programming against them, like, you know, like I can now see why something like this is super important when you're talking about, you know, a web app that's making a ton of transactions and records to that database. You want to make sure that they're consistent and not overwriting each other and all those types of things. And I've found that because I'm a, you know, SQL noob, creating everything in a transaction that's easily put back is pretty handy.
It's very useful for syncing large data sets, because I thinking back to when I've worked with Salesforce data, all the data's in different tables. They all have primary keys or foreign keys. And if you're going to do one import and it succeeded, and then the second one failed, it leaves things in a bit of a weird state. So, this is super useful, especially for large data sets.
And it's interesting that, you know, the way they're phrasing this, where it's, you know, it's moving these traditional things that have been in relational databases for a long time, but it's the analytical sort of big data sort of offerings. And it's interesting to see how that transforms over time.
It'll be another interesting to see. Let's move on to Microsoft Azure. Azure Confidential Computing on 4th-gen Intel Xeon Scalable Processors with Intel TDX is now been announced. This is the 4th-gen Intel Xeon Scalable Processors with the Trusted Domain Extensions, or Intel TDX, which will be available sometime later this year. Of course, no dates. Thank you, Microsoft. TDX meets the Confidential Computing Consortium CCC standard for hardware-enforced memory protection not controlled by the cloud provider, all while delivering minimal performance impact with no code changes.
I mean, you know why it's not ready yet, right? Because Intel only released them yesterday.
I mean, facts. Like,
talk about jumping the gun on the press release. Yeah. Ride the SEO wave.
It's going to be one of those things, too, where it's like, well, everyone's getting these chips because Intel sold them to all the cloud providers. And if we get our announcement out first, then we can, you know, get some buzz. But I'm sure Amazon will follow suit and Google as well. And then we'll all wait for processor yields to get higher because they'll be way behind, like Intel likes to be.
Yeah, the trusted execution environment stuff is interesting, and I'm sure there's big customers asking for that. But in general, those 4th-gen Xeons are super nice CPUs. Intel are doing a really good job at that, the high end of the CPU line. They specifically have instructions for like matrix multiplication and things like that now, which is speeds up AI work, machine learning work immensely. So I think Intel... All hope is not lost for Intel.
Yeah. Well, they also made an acquisition this week. They announced the acquisition of Fungible Inc., a provider of composable infrastructure aimed at accelerating networking and storage performance in data centers with highly efficiency, lower power data processing units, or DPUs for short. Fungible's tech will enable high performance, scalable, disaggregated, scaled out data center infrastructure with reliability and security. Fungible will join Microsoft data center infrastructure engineering teams and focus on delivering multiple DPU solutions, networking innovation, and hardware systems advancements. And so before the show, we all had to go research what this company was, because none of us knew
what any of that meant.
Well, we all disagreed on what it meant. So, you know, Ryan was like, it's a storage thing. And Jonathan, I think, said something else. I don't remember what it was. And I said, I think it's a CPU of some kind. And then we all came to the conclusion that this is, they just bought Nitro. That's basically what we figured out, is it's the ability for you to run the hypervisor off of the main compute processing unit. So if you want like a bare metal server, you could use this technology to move the hypervisor off of the chip, and then you can basically get the full chip capacity available to the hypervisor layer. And so I suspect this is a Nitro opportunity for Microsoft to really do some big innovation in hypervisor technology with ARM chips and Nitro type technology, just like Amazon has, and I think Google does as well.
I found a really funny quote about Fungible from a couple of years ago, not long after they started up. And it says, Fungible, the chip startup that says its aim is to put smaller cloud providers on a more equal hardware footing with the likes of Amazon Web Services.
Well, Azure is a smaller cloud footprint than Amazon. Yeah. So yeah, that's right. It's perfect.
Done and done.
So yeah, we'll see. We'll see where that comes out later this year, and what that actually ends up meaning. Because I'm sure there'll be some product coming soon to talk about all the excitement of that. You think it's partially the Charlie Bell influence? Like, you guys really need this, and so they found a company they had and they bought it, or do you think it had nothing to do with that?
Oh, I can't see how it couldn't be. I mean, if you think about, you know, the security that you get in the isolation of running a workload like this, like, you know, like it's got to be the elephant in the room at all times when you're thinking about, you know, just the scale of multi-tenancy that you have as a cloud provider. So, and this is, you know, this is the best tried and true way to sort of get that isolation at a, you know, at such a low level where you can always point at it and be like, see, we got our protections right there. It's fine.
Yep.
We're okay.
Have you been waiting months and months to hire your new AWS, GCP, or Azure architect only to have them be poached at the 11th hour by a startup with a juice bar? Initiative stalled because you're having trouble hiring? Well, I have a simple solution, Foghorn Consulting. Falcon Consulting provides top-notch cloud engineers to the world's most innovative companies and can be burning down your DevOps and cloud backlogs as soon as next week. Falcon certified AWS, GCP, and Azure professionals are armed with infrastructure as code and from day one will be designing performant, optimized cloud-native or hybrid environments that deliver on the promise of cloud. Their FogOps solution even provides on-demand cloud engineering to augment your existing teams. Visit www.foghornconsulting.com or send an email to cloudtalentnow@foghornconsulting.com and tell them the CloudPod sent you. Your dedicated FogOps team is with you for the long haul, and they bring their own juice.
All right, let's move on to the Cloud Journey Series, episode 2 on our CCOE topic here. So last week we talked about the structure of the team and the why. We talked about, you know, architects, networking people, cloud DevOps folks, security, potentially having HR on your CCOE. We talked about finance being a partner of your CCOE. And so this week, you know, we want to talk about, now you have a team, how do you establish the charter? And so, you know, what is the charter of your CCOE? And I think the charter evolves a little bit depending on how you kind of approach the cloud in general. But, you know, if the CCOE was created because you want to go experiment with cloud and you want to go figure out what cloud is, then I think it's figuring out the business case. I think if you've already said, like, we're going to the cloud, now we need to make it happen, I think you're starting to figure out more of the standard side of it. But ultimately, what do you guys think? What does the charter look like for CCOE?
I think it depends on what the business is trying to do, to be honest. I mean, if you're in the, we're migrating to the cloud part of the life cycle, then the charter will be completely different than if that's not where you are as a business. So I think the first thing is that the charter needs to align with the business's goals in general. So whatever we talk about here, it may be more specific to the kind of work we're doing, but it may not necessarily apply to anybody else.
I mean, I think that the charter stays relatively the same, but I do think that the priorities within that do change based on that need, right? Because I feel like every time I've started a CCOE, one of the first things is holding the business accountable for what they say they want versus what they actually want. And so, like, it's really difficult to sort of base the charter based on that need. But I mean, I think the format does have, you know, kind of align to at least general themes, right? With probably different priorities as far as innovation or optimization or cost savings. But, you know, you want the center of excellence to be sort of that bridge to guide the business to how to operate in the cloud. And that's not going to change depending on what your priorities are. You know, you might have to do some translation and you might have to do some confirmation and some massaging to get that, you know, that line of the business correct.
I mean, so, like, I guess part of the charter we write needs to address not why we want a CCOE, because we kind of touched on that last week, but yeah, we do want to stop people going off and doing their own things. We don't want little groups doing shadow IT. You know, I don't like the way these guys are doing cloud. I'm going to do it my own way and going off and doing their own thing. So I think when you define the charter, it really needs to address or sort of bear in mind why people would break off and do their own things and sort of try and accommodate for the differences and different needs from different teams.
Yeah. And, you know, like, even, you know, like, if you shadow IT is definitely like a worry, but, you know, even if you don't really, if you have like a real program and you have that in place, but you don't really have that sort of governance or that sort of coordinating body in the center, that's really providing the guidance to someone who's discovering a new technology needs to adopt it quickly. Like, that's where you end up getting different standards, different naming conventions, different things, you know, where that'll prevent you from doing, you know, cost visualization across your entire cloud later, or, you know, security that consistently across all your environments. And, you know, I think that's really, you know, a lot of the benefit you get by having a center of excellence starting from the beginning, or at least early in your cloud journey that way.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking about, as you're talking through that, and, you know, there's this belief that, you know, reasons you go to cloud, right? And I was thinking about, you know, cost is one of the reasons people throw out there. Accelerating innovation is an area that, you know, the business will throw out there. We'll talk about being more agile and being able to accommodate needs and high growth, or enabling access to new technologies like big data and AI and machine learning. And you kind of have like these narratives that kind of exist. And, you know, anyone who's been in cloud long enough goes like, if you're moving to the cloud to save money, that's the worst reason to go to the cloud. But the other ones are sort of interesting too. And I think we've all kind of seen some of those experiences where, you know, you want to see innovation speed up, but then, you know, you either have over locked it down because you built a really strong data center, you know, concept with like really strong controls, or you see like the wild, wild west. And really, I think as you think about the charter of the CCOE, you're talking about, you know, being somewhere in the middle of that. So you don't want to get in the extreme of complete lockdown. We can't do anything. We don't get any of those things I just talked about, innovation and agility and speed, and definitely higher cost in that scenario. And oh my God, everyone can go create their own project, their own account. They can get their own credit card. They can, you know, set up their own VPCs and have overlapping IP addresses and the wild, wild west side of it, which is the complete opposite side, so I think you're really, the CCOE's goal and kind of charter as you think about it is, how do I take those business concerns and how do I allow agility and speed and innovation, but in a way that doesn't end up in those two extremes?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of businesses aren't honest with themselves when they decide to go into the cloud. You know, like, we want the agility. Do you want agility, or do you want to not have the same bottlenecks that your current infrastructure provides you, right? Like, do you need agility? What are the business drivers for that agility? Are you going to take advantage by re-architecting or adding features to your app to take advantage of things like, you know, provisioning on demand? Because it's, you know, like, so many times I think that's just a lie that people say is like, we'll be able to add all this flexibility and we'll be able to only pay for what our current demand is. But then there's never that flip side of it, because you can't just take an app from one ecosystem and move it into another and just have it magically work, despite all, you know, the documentation otherwise, right? It's there's a lot of work and plans and architecture that needs to be designed and, you know, and committed to towards that effort. Which is why the cost fallacy is there, right? It's really difficult to actually pull that off, to transfer one to another and actually have it cost less. Like, there's a lot of work that has to be done in order to do that. So, like, you know, I think that there is that challenge. You want to define what the business needs are up front so that you can sort of figure out where your tactics are. But then you also, I think the Cloud Center of Excellence, a key part of that charter is to sort of keep the business honest, because I think that, you know, so many times does it get started with that as the intent, but the reality is, it's like, no, it takes us too long to do business today. And if they fixed that in place, it would be a better solution than moving to the cloud. So I think CCOE should be aware of that.
Yeah. I think the thing too, the other big pattern I've seen, you know, and I've come in to fix a lot of cloud deployments and how they've gone to cloud and fix some of those fundamental things where those visions were lost. I think you also see, you know, the teams who are like, okay, for us to get to cloud, we have to do all this internal work and we're going to spend, you know, the next 12 to 18 months, you know, working on all this automation and getting all these things ready. And then when we're done with that, we'll be ready to go to the cloud. And I think that results in the CTO getting fired, the CIO getting fired, whoever's responsible for the cloud thing, because you didn't deliver any of the things the business cared about for 18 months, and that's not good. Or you have the, you know, again, the need to, how do I do both, right? How do I build the guardrails, build the automation, enable it, but at the same time do small proofs of concept to prove things out and be more agile, really, at the end of the day? And how do you force agile thinking into your infrastructure team to actually deliver that as an iterative process versus big bang IT projects?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge, right? That's the ideal, is to be able to do both those things at once. And I think that's, you know, having a center of excellence who's part of their charter is that communication of that full vision and end, right? That's the key part of that, right? Because it's, you know, I don't know how long it takes to get an actual business return where you can see your costs, you know, following your demand and that type of thing. But, you know, it's going to not be as quick as people want. I know that for a fact, right? So it's, you have to be able to communicate that plan. And this is where you are and this is where you want to be. And these are the milestones that you can expect us to cross as we get there.
You know, we talked about members of the team last week and perhaps recruiting people who are trusted in the business, people who are respected by the teams, or more respected than others maybe. I think the charter of the CCOE should probably start out small and then grow over time. It's only because the team needs to establish themselves as winners, and then succeed. As I think if you take on too much too early, you have 10 projects to manage, you have finance to be concerned with, and everything else. Chances are you're going to fail, and you'll lose confidence. You'll either lose confidence from the engineers or the executive team, and that's not a good place to start. So I think when defining the charter, I think you should start off with some small achievable goals. Communication is obviously important because this is all about advocacy. And once you've sort of earned the trust and earned the right to take on a little bit more, otherwise, I think jumping in and trying to do everything all at once is probably not the best plan.
Yeah. You know, we talked about the kind of the three big things that Cloud Center of Excellence delivers around governance, architecture, or evangelism. And I think you're right. Again, it goes back to which of those three things do you need to deliver first? And that's where you should focus the CCOE and then expand into the other charters. I think while evangelism is kind of the fun thing to go out there and rah, rah, rah about cloud and cloud native and the future of cloud and, you know, cloud fails and 12-factor architecture, that's a lot of fun. And, you know, like a field CTO type person really loves those kinds of things. The architecture and governance are probably where you need to start a lot of your thinking. And then as you kind of get through the first year, you can start adding in that evangelism and saying here, and then you have proof points in your business too. Like, hey, we took this team over here. We did a POC. We got them onto containers. And now they're out evangelizing to their peers and saying, this cloud thing is awesome and really something I can do a lot with. I think that helps you kind of go through that process.
Yeah, you don't want to evangelize too early before you're ready. I mean, if you haven't built out the platform and you haven't built out the structure, going and telling everyone to start using it's just going to lead to a bit of misery because people will suddenly realize that you're not ready, that you don't have the services they need. And it does turn into the Wild West. So yeah, hold on the evangelism.
Yeah. It's, what a letdown, right? Like of all these opportunities I have by developing cloud native and all those things, and you go to your CCOE and they're like, oh yeah, not yet.
Yeah.
It's like the Aladdin genie. Immense power, tiny living space.
This weekend I went home and I spun up a Kubernetes cluster on my lab and I built out an app and I'm ready to go. And then CCOE is like, yeah, we're 6 months away from being ready.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's never no good. Never any good there. So thinking about, you know, again, we're talking about the business and aligning the business charter with that, you know, it kind of brings me to like, who are our stakeholders in this particular conversation? So from, you know, an IT perspective, you have your CIO and your CTO potentially, as well as potentially a chief product officer or a product type team. Cause if you're doing innovation, but like where else do you think, you know, stakeholders should be and should be kind of kept up to date on what the CCOE is doing?
I mean, I think there's a couple of big ones, right? Like, I think security and is the largest one that I can see, right? Like figuring out who gets access to your newly formed cloud, who gets access to the resources in it. How are we going to ensure that the business is safe and have that visibility? And then how are we going to react if there is a potential breach? I think are big things to answer very early. You know, I also, you know, there's a big financial change when it comes towards cloud and the way you visualize and communicate the health of your business to either, you know, the private equity firm that owns you, your shareholders, or just whoever's in charge. And so that I think is also super important to have as well, because a lot of these terms, you sort of have to translate terms in order to sell a cohesive picture of the change that you need to get accomplished.
Yeah, I think you kind of need to define the whole racing matrix fairly early on so that everyone understands who's responsible for what. And as part of that process, you identify the stakeholders.
Yeah.
And the roles.
The executive stakeholders that I think about when, you know, CISO is a great one too. It's a great addition. You know, CIO, CTO, of course, they're probably one of them driving you down this path. CFO, pretty big executive stakeholder in this conversation, especially, you know, the translation from capital dollars to operational dollars, the bubble costs. If you're going to be doing a large migration, that becomes a big drag potentially on gross margin of a business. So CFO is a pretty big stakeholder who needs to be on board and aligned. And then the CEO, I think at the end of the day, because again, you know, the company has to rally. And in many ways, a cloud transformation is the beginning of a digital transformation, which is a much larger executive team transformation that has to occur across an entire business, and you know, potentially go to market strategies with mobile and web e-commerce, to you know, how do you enable people in stores and storefronts? So there's lots of pieces to this that cloud, you know, being, you know, the different stakeholders, the cloud stakeholders become eventually we start leading into some of the other big executive transformations you might do. And ultimately the board has to sign off on these things. So you're talking about spending potentially in a large IT enterprise, you know, several hundred million dollars over multiple years with a big cloud provider. The board's going to want to know about it too. And they're going to want to know what the strategy is and those things. And those are important stakeholders to have in your thoughts as your CCO is forming as well. Who needs to be informed? Who needs to be updated? Who needs to be aware of these changes as they go through?
I think looking sort of sideways to adjacent teams as well, we would want at least collaboration or to treat the, you know, the PMO, project management team, as mm-hmm. as stakeholders, because we're going to be changing processes. We're going to be defining new processes. We'll have a, you know, an intake process for new services, review processes, planning and project management. I think the CCOE drives change all over the business, not just in the choice of technology, but also in formalizing processes to ensure success. And so I think really I can't think of anybody who isn't a stakeholder in the transformation.
Yeah. I mean, everyone has a touch at some point, but again, it's who's the key ones first, but yeah, it does touch everything over time. So, you know, some of the areas of strategy that your CCOE should be thinking about, and you know, some of the ones that I am expecting from a CCOE to come out of the door is, you know, things around IAM, security policies and security standards, networking and VPC design, accounts if you're in AWS land, or projects in the Azure GCP land, tagging strategies. What are some other areas that you potentially see the, you know, are things that are fundamental to a cloud CCOE to kind of think about? And we'll get into these in more depth in future weeks as we talk about some of these other ones. But you know, just kind of thinking like higher level, like what are some of the deliverables like those that I just mentioned that, you know, you might think about as part of your CCOE charter?
I think you covered a lot of it. I think that, you know, the important part is really thinking about how you're going to offer your service to the business, right? What is the interaction level that you expect? Are you taking workloads from existing teams and moving them into this cloud center of excellence? Or is the idea they're building repeatable patterns to hand them over to that team? And so depending on what it sort of looks like and what your long-term plan is, it sort of really depends on what that focus should be. But in the end, it's all going to boil down to a service and an offering that you're providing the business. And so tailoring it really to the business as the business needs it. And I think that's really key. And so, you know, you have to have things like cost visibility, and so therefore tagging. These days, tagging becomes more important than just sort of visibility. It's not just metadata for a resource. You're defining access policies based on tags, you know, both at the security level and at the user access level. And so like it's, you know, there's a lot of fundamental things that I think are key to have up front, but there's no master list of things I can think of. I would think that there are a couple key things that can be really important when you think about, you know, transitioning workloads. The way that you sort of manage application diagnostics can be really different in the cloud. So having a strategy there is one area where there would be a big difference. You know, like are you just going to turn a whole lot of Splunk and have, you know, your normal logging pattern sort of move with your applications? Or are you going to really invest in more modern observability practices that are easier to manage in the cloud ecosystem?
I think one of the other things we should look at as well is what we don't want is a data center in the sky. We don't want to move all the existing tooling, as you mentioned, Ryan. I think one of the responsibilities of the CCOE should be to sort of reevaluate those technology decisions. You know, does Sophos antivirus still work for us? Does a particular appliance that we had in the data center, do we virtualize that, or do we find a cloud native solution for that? I think we need to really critically think about all the sort of underlying components of the stack and figure out, does it make sense to move as is? Does it make sense to transform? Do we even need it anymore?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the challenge is that there's a comfort and CCUE has kind of pushed people out of their comfort zone, right? Like the classic one I've seen many times is F5s. You know, we've been an F5 on data center for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. I know F5 outside now. I know it handles our use case. And then you run into things like, well, you know, we have thousands of sites coming to a single F5 and then getting dispersed out to the back-end load balancers. And then they go, you know, but if you look at, you know, Amazon's load balancer, they only can support 20 rules in their application thing. And we have thousands of them. And it's like, yeah, you're right. But why do I have to have just one ALB? Why can't I have 100 ALBs or 1,000 ALBs and distribute that load and reduce the risk in the blast radius? And that's a different thought process. That's cloud native thinking about it versus data center thinking about it. And that's where you sort of get into this challenge of, you know, those type of issues. And so those are hard conversations sometimes, especially when, you know, someone's like, well, I'm certified double black belt, whatever, in F5, and I don't want to give up that knowledge. And then that's where you end up in a situation long-term where potentially that person doesn't have a role in your org if you get rid of F5. But you'll find that people typically try to find all the reasons why the cloud native solution doesn't work or doesn't meet all the requirements. And then I would say the cloud center of excellence job is to actually challenge the requirements in some cases too. Like, when did that requirement get written? Who wrote it? And is it still valid? And why is it valid? And in some cases you might find that it is true and it is better. But a lot of times it's, you know, 10 years ago, there was a standard that we met that made us do this thing and no one's ever questioned it.
I think that part of the driver of that though is that it's very traditionally been infrastructure and operations versus application engineering. And cloud enables, you know, software engineers to deploy these things as part of their application to, you know, to use managed services as though they were part of your stack. But historically, it's been, you know, ticket to IT. I need to make this change on this appliance. There's never been an API. It's been Jira tickets or ServiceNow or something else. And so in the cloud migration, that's all we know. We don't have the tooling to automate configuring the, you know, Google's load balancers or Amazon's load balancers or anything else. So it's seen as extra work, I think. You know, it was so much easier when we just sent a ticket to Bob, who could just make this change for us in 5 minutes. But now you're asking us to build this out as a service. And so it does introduce more work in some cases, but it's the right work and it's the right direction to go.
Well, and I think that's a large, CCOE is going to have to spin out that narrative, right? Because that's, you know, even if you are still offsetting the responsibility of that serving traffic to another team rather than maintaining it with the engineering team, that team, if they're used to managing F5s, you know, that's a single appliance that does 1,000 things. It's a one point stop where they can just do all of those actions. And yeah, the cloud native, you're scaling that out horizontally, not vertically. And so you're not going to be able to administer that the same way. Like, and that's the first complaint I've heard from infrastructure teams is like, well, you're going to make me manage 100 of these things. Like, yeah, I am. Oh, not by hand. No, that would be crazy.
Wait, you want me to manage it, but you're not letting me have any pod access. What's wrong with you, Ryan?
Like, no, we're going to build an application because you can't do this by hand anymore. Like, it doesn't work.
Well, I think that was a good covering of, you know, the big areas. Anything, I'm thinking about pitfalls. Like, have you guys seen a CCOE or anything in the space where you're like, "Whoa, that was a bad direction. Maybe you should think that differently." Or an area that you guys tried and didn't work in the CCOE space?
I mean, I think the early advocacy is the biggest thing I can think of. Pimping the cloud and then being unable to deliver on basic things like centralized logging infrastructure. You know, sensible IAM governance or account management, and in part, it's not entirely, you know, our fault or because as early adopters, because maybe AWS didn't have the service we needed back then, and we sort of fumbled around a little bit. I think you really need to make sure you get a robust platform defined before you start trying to adopt cloud. I mean, jumping into cloud before you're ready is very expensive.
Yeah. I'd also say that, like, don't be afraid of pitfalls, because one of the best things about this is that because it is infrastructure that's an API request away, it's also, you know, much easier to pivot. And so, you know, I have, you know, no, there are pitfalls that, you know, common patterns of communication that, you know, and hurdles that I know exist within businesses when forming a CCOE. But there's also, I don't want to be afraid of making mistakes. You know, like I think about my first foray into Kubernetes and transforming an app into to be container-based from server-based. And it didn't work. Like, it wasn't a failure from a business standpoint. It did what it was supposed to, but it would have been, you know, it was completely unmanageable from a any kind of real perspective where we couldn't maintain it, right? But we were able to very quickly sort of change direction based on that and supply a solution that was manageable and was suitable for the business, all without really impacting the bottom line for the business. And so like, it's one of those things where, yeah, there are pitfalls, but there's also, you know, there, it's also a little easier to rescue yourself when you make a mistake or you go down a path of discovery and you realize it's not going to work out.
I think actually another thing comes to mind is, people say they want to go to cloud. We'll have a shareholder meeting. Oh, yes, we're migrating to cloud. It's going to take this many years. It's going to cost this much money. We're all in on cloud. And then it's kind of empty promises. I think I've seen failures in cloud migrations because really the executive support or the right executive support wasn't there. So we want to go to cloud and it's your job to get us there, except we're not going to invest anything in modifying the product, any engineering time. And so I think ensuring you have the right executive support at the beginning before you start in blood is is absolutely necessary.
Yeah, there's, like you said, there's, it touches every side of the business, right? And so it's, and you really need to have that buy-in from everything. So if you are going to move something that already exists, like a lot of times your customer support patterns are going to have to change. Your technical documentation is going to have to change. The way you monitor, the way you've communicated your application health to your customers, a lot of these things change as part of that transformation. And so it's very quick to pull on a thread and realize that you're unraveling a whole sweater. And it's, you know, I think that that's probably the one thing I would avoid is thinking that you can do something very quickly and easily. But if you don't have a cohesive understanding of all the players involved and all the different processes that are going to change, like you can definitely burn some bridges pretty quick and lose some face.
Yeah. I mean, the communication is a vital part of being a CCOE. But the other side of that is, the business needs to make sure that the rest of the business, all the silos, all the teams, know that you are the CCOE and that this is your mandate and this is what you've been asked to do. Mm-hmm. Because it's very frustrating to be an architect or an engineer in a CCOE and provide advice and people are like, well, who are you? Who are you to tell me this? No, this is the way we've always done it. You really need to kind of have backup. That message needs to have been sent.
I thought it was your job to do all this transformation, but not really.
Yeah.
All right. Well, next week we're going to get to one of those meaty topics I mentioned earlier. I'm talking all about all of the pitfalls and dangers of IAM, what you need to think about as you think about least privilege, zero trust access, and all kinds of fun that is, you know, we'll be in buzzword bingo territory, so get your boards ready.
Oh, yeah.
But lots of really, you know, important conversations need to happen around IAM and how you think about this particular area. So looking forward to that next week, guys. And that's been another fantastic week here in the cloud.
See you later.
Bye, everybody.
And that is the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Foghorn Consulting. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and tweet us your feedback at #TheCloudPod. Or join our Slack channel, go to our website, thecloudpod.net for sign-up instructions.